Hey everyone, I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, editor of TheVertical.com on Yahoo Sports and host of The Vertical Podcast with Woj. I'm here at the Philadelphia 76ers brand new practice and training facility on the waterfront in Camden, New Jersey with Sixers center Joel Embiid and coach Brett Brown. Embiid has been one of the most fascinating figures and stories of the past 2 years plus in the NBA, a monumentally talented young star who went two full years without playing an NBA game as he fought through multiple foot surgeries and injuries. But now everyone is starting to understand that the intrigue over him was justified, that he might even exceed the massive expectations that have accompanied his debut this season. I asked Joel about the perceptions that Americans had of him as a young man coming to the States to play basketball, the stereotypes about the environment in which he was raised across the world.
When they think about Africans, they think about, you know, just us running around with lions and tigers and, all those other animals. So when I got to Kansas, I kind of used that to my advantage, talking about kill the lion. And that's how I became a man, because at 6 years old, I had to go in the jungle and killed a lion and carried it on my back.
I asked Brett Brown about the night he spent in his young star's apartment and the aftermath of Joel's younger brother Arthur being tragically killed back home in Cameroon by a reckless motorist careening into a playground.
That, for me, was one of the darkest nights of my life. I mean, to see Joel in the state that he was in and to feel very helpless on anything you could do to help other than just sort of be there to be with him was a long night.
Joel is one of the most engaging, intelligent, thoughtful young players you'll come across in the league. People have not heard a great deal from him in the 2 years that preceded his debut this season. I think you're going to really enjoy this visit with he and Brett Brown. Let's do it. Here at the Sixers' new practice facility in Camden with Sixers center Joel Embiid and coach Brett Brown. First, guys, Joel, before we went on air, we were talking about this facility, which is just, I haven't seen the whole thing yet, but extraordinary, especially considering what the Sixers used to have. Probably not only 30th in the NBA, but maybe 200th out of 300 college programs, right? What's it like coming to work here every day, Joel?
It's great. Finally, the old practice facility was kind of old and small. So to get a chance to finally have a new one and way bigger one than the one we used to have is just great. And the environment coming in, it just makes all of us want to stay in the gym and just walk out or just go enjoy a meal or just go and play video games upstairs.
Through your rehab the last 2 years, it might have been nice to have this one, right? But I guess you...
Yeah, it could have been nice, but I got the job done, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, you did. There's a lot to talk about, guys, and the partnership, Joel, you've had with Coach Brown here over the last couple years as you prepared to make your debut this season. But I want to ask first about, because both of you have very worldly experiences. Joel, you grew up in Cameroon, in Africa, came here as a 16-year-old. And Brett grew up in New England, and you've coached in the NBA, but lived and worked in Australia and coached internationally. You've been all over the world. What kind of reaction are you both getting from the election, from friends, family, around the world? I'll start with you first, Brett, because I know politics. Listen, you spent a lot of hours with Greg Popovich. I'm sure you two have talked a lot about this election cycle.
The question that you're asking us both is very timely. It's something that Joel and I spoke about this morning. And you are right. I have lived overseas and worked overseas for a very long time. And what you find is overseas, the media will grab small portions to paint a very vivid picture in the way that they want. And the vivid picture that was painted on Donald Trump was all of the foibles. You know, nobody that I remember has come in as unfiltered as Donald Trump has. And he's touched all places from alleged racism to the obvious ones dealing with women. And so my foreign friends bring that up and are in shock that he has been elected as our president. And the feedback that I get from the people overseas is very much pointed in that direction.
Joel, just your view as, you know, somebody who's grew up in Africa, lived here, and seen the United States, I'm sure the view you had of America as a kid in Africa, probably different than the reality of being here. What's been the feedback you've gotten on Trump and his election?
Obviously, like you said, growing up in Cameroon, you know, I've always thought that the U.S. was just amazing, and like it was just a dream, and I thought it was heaven. And then coming here a couple of years ago, you know, the U.S. is still nice, but it's not like what I thought it was going to be. And with the election going on, and you know that Donald Trump just got elected, and I just feel like, I mean, I don't usually get into politics, but with the way he's been acting and, you know, talking about racism or women, it's just hard to, like, understand why people elected him. And it just shows you the way people think and, you know, that, and he's all about, I feel like, racism isn't over, and that's still people that stay behind, and people still like want to, I don't know, talk about it or take actions towards it, and it's just a shame. But from what I got from this election, you know, the media made it seem like it's just gonna be really bad, and like the world was over. But I feel like it's not going to be as bad as people makes it out to be. And I hope it's not going to be like that. But, I don't know.
You did have the tweet. For me, anyway, you had the tweet of the night in the election. Well, America is tanking. But the one thing for both Brett and Joel, the NBA has always been, I think, more than any other sport, it is a melting pot. There's no more international sport in the U.S. than the NBA. And, you know, you certainly experienced that in San Antonio, probably before a lot of organizations did, players internationally. And to me, it's always been a pretty good model for the rest of society. It's not perfect. And we've seen coaches and players speak out, Stan Van Gundy, Steve Kerr, you know, others and players. Does the NBA have an opportunity, Brett, do you think, to maybe lead in terms of race and the relationships, and if something needs to be here countered in the culture, that the NBA's got a unique role here because of the credibility it has in all those areas and the way it's been out ahead of some things?
I mean, the platform that Joel and all of the NBA players have truly is amazing. The people that can be reached, the people that can be influenced, and really an incredibly short period of time through social media and just the stage that they're on, all that comes with, I think, an opportunity and a responsibility. And I feel like over the years, this is my 16th year in the NBA, that they are more and more and more aware of these opportunities. You know, the young guys coming through, to me, are articulate. I think that they are conscientious for the most part. And I think that this sort of league that we're all in, it just keeps getting more and more in regards to opportunities to speak your piece and to tell your story.
Joel, getting back to basketball and your preparation for this season, what you went through the 2 years that you had to sit in the NBA and wait through the surgeries and the healing, what did you learn about patience? What did that teach you that you think maybe carries you forward, not just in basketball, but in life?
I mean, for the past 2 years, I went through injuries and rehab and the loss of my brother. I just going through the injury the first time. One thing I learned, mainly it was going through the injury for the second time, I learned about patience. And during my first time rehabbing, I felt like I wasn't patient. I wasn't educated about my injury. I wasn't educated about my body. You know, I was young, coming into the league, really young, and I didn't know what to expect, live by myself. So it was hard then. And then I also wanted to play, and I couldn't get that chance. So I went through a rough time and then losing my brother. So that was another thing that really bothered me. And then the second time around, just going through that, I had the support from the team. You know, that's where I learned that patience is the key. Because my first year, I felt like I kind of pushed. Like getting back on the court, I was... most time I wasn't listening to what I was being told. So the second time around, and the team that really let me take my time and rest my foot, and I was just being patient and I was doing whatever I was supposed to do, and it paid off, and getting a chance to finally get back on the court and helping my team, it's just great.
So you talk about feeling like you didn't listen as much the first year as, looking back, you should have. Coaches sort of talked a lot about your competitiveness, and part of what people think is going to help make you great and fulfill your potential is that competitive nature. But when you're rehabbing and you're sitting out, it's something that ends up working against the mindset you have to have. Is that what you – was that kind of the internal fight in you that was going on?
Yeah, that was a conflict. You know, I want to play. I love basketball, and I want to be on the court. And not being able to was tough. So, and then that was basically my first time, really going through a tough injury. And, you know, with the losing associated, and mainly because I felt like I could have helped the team. And, you know, one thing that was hard was that I had to, like, come in and, like, sit on the bench every game and just like really watch us lose every night. So that was hard. But, and the second time around, everything changed. But, there was really a conflict. You know, I want, like his coach always talking about how competitive I am. So that's what the conflict was.
Looking back, you changed a little bit in the second year in terms of Joel traveling with the team, being around it. I think the thought initially was, you know, we don't want him to be isolated. We want him to be a part of things. Did that idea, in theory, not work out as well in practice as you guys imagined, Brett?
I think in hindsight that is true. And I feel like when I sit here and I listen to Joe answer that question, you know, I get a flood of things that come to my mind because I've been lucky to be here with Joel through all of it. And I think to step back and know how competitive, and that's been taken away, and he's young, and he's living by himself, and as he admitted, the loss of his brother, it all factored into, you know, he's frustrated. And I think that when we reached out to people like Zarunas Agalskis, we hired a sports scientist to come in and help Joel, Dr. David Martin. We went overboard with sports science. We dug in a little bit. I mean, think about it. We sent him to the Middle East. We sent him to Doha, Qatar. And, you know, whatever we could do to help him, we did it. Z came in and, you know, shared a real-time, real-life experience saying what Joel just admitted, you know, to come in and think we're doing the right thing and say, hey, come be a part of the team, learn. You feel like that's the right thing to grow him because you feel like it's not that far away he's going to be with us. But I think in hindsight to work with Joel and to try to find a fair and reasonable balance that we strike, all those things have been a lesson. And to see him now out on the court after those few years of, you know, some tough yards is very exciting for all of us.
Joel, you mentioned the losing, and as the team is struggling and is, you know, something that's become a, you know, a joke around the league. People laugh about it or people ridiculed Philly. there's always some record coming, consecutive losses, and, you know, is it going to have the worst record in the league? The focus was always on you. It was, well, Embiid is coming. He's coming. You were seen as a savior. You still are here, and people now have seen your potential, but everyone's calling for you. Come save us from this. How did that impact you listening to that day after day?
I think it affected me a lot, especially, you know, injuries are something you can't control, and like people always, you know, on social media and everywhere, walking on the street, people asking you when you're going to play, and like basically people are saying that you're faking injuries because you don't want to play. That played a big, like, a big role, and it was hard. And then, you know, like you said, people, I mean, I was the third pick, so people expect me to come in and dominate and just bring the Sixers back to where they used to be. But going through those injuries, one thing I learned, it was also patience, and that's still going on. And about the process, you know, when I'm always mention process, people think I may be talking about the team process, and I don't know whatever that was going on before I got here, but that's where they got that process from. But when I always talk about processes, I feel like it's my process, you know, starting, you know, I always say my life is a movie. Because I, you know, started playing basketball in 2011 and just like that, getting a chance to come to the state and play JV my junior year in high school and transfer to another school, my senior year, get offers just like that, and then go to Kansas, play a couple pickup games against the guys, and get from getting dunked on, I decided to go talk to coach and tell him that I want a red shirt because I felt like I wasn't ready. And then just like that, he tells me that, nah, you're going to be the number one pick in 2 years. And I'm like, people told me that college coaches always lie. So I'm like, you lie. I don't believe that. And he just told me keep walking. And I listened to him, just kept walking, and There you go. People start talking about you being the number one pick out of nowhere. So everything just happened so fast for me. Coming to Philly, getting injured, and having to get 2 surgeries and finally get back on the court. I mean, it's hard, but I feel like that's the process. Like when I measure process, that's what I'm talking about, like by process. Feel like that's my process.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Joel, as long as you have this minutes restriction with the Sixers, I think I've got an endorsement play for you here. Movement watches. We can monitor, measure your 20 minutes a game to your 24 minutes a game. I'll get your agent in touch with them. But first, Joel, let me tell my listeners about Movement Watches. Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style should not break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. With over 500,000 watches sold to customers in 160-plus countries all around the world, Movement Watches has solidified itself as the world's fastest-growing watch company. The company started by 2 broke college kids who wanted to wear stylish watches but couldn't afford them, so they started their own watch company. Movement Watches start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Movement offers classic design, quality construction, and styled minimalism, and they have sold over 500,000 watches in over 160 countries. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com. That's MVMTwatches.com/Woj. Now is the time to step up your watch game. So go to movementwatches.com/Woj. That's MVMT,
www.ccwatches.com/Woj and join the movement. And now back to my guest today, Joel Embiid and Sixers coach Brett Brown. Joel, you were 15 years old, and at that age, you were thinking about being a volleyball player back home, and you went to a basketball camp. Luke Mamute, who became your teammate here in Philly, essentially discovered you and came back and said, hey, there's someone there that people here need to know about. The transformation for you, you haven't played, I don't think there's anybody your age in the NBA who's played less basketball in their life than you have, and yet, you know, you have a chance to be better than all of them. Did it just come easily? Did the more you play, you started with a volleyball on the court, and were you shocked at times that, hey, I'm getting really good at this, and it's coming fast? Did it almost scare you at some points?
I would say it's kind of scary. But one thing, I think the mindset I had coming to the state was going to be, you know, I came to the state and I was by myself and I didn't really know anybody and I didn't know the language. So coming into the state, I felt like basketball was like my only way out, and that was cool too. If basketball hadn't worked out, I was probably going to be, and I love math. Math was my favorite subject when I was going to school. So I felt like my mindset was about basketball. I felt like, and then going in, you know, in high school, my teammates used to make fun of me. So that just gave me some type of fool, and I just wanted to be better than them. But I don't know. So,
what was your childhood like? Your dad was a military officer. You mentioned your younger brother Arthur, who died in 2014. You have a younger sister. I think sometimes, and you said this in the great Lee Jenkins piece in Sports Illustrated, that people have a perception that if you were from Africa, that you grew up in the outskirts, in the hinterlands, and you grew up in the second biggest city in the country, in a what would be considered here maybe an upper middle class family. Is your childhood different than people here seem to imagine when they're either talk to you or make assumptions?
Yeah, Americans, I feel like since I've been here, I feel like Americans, they don't really have any idea of what's going on in the world. And especially us Africans, I feel like when you talk about, when they think about Africans, they think about, you know, just us running around with lions and tigers and I don't know, all those other animals. So when I got to Kansas, I kind of used that to my advantage, talking about I killed the lion, and that's how I became a man, because at 6 years old, I had to go in the jungle and kill the lion and carried it on my back to bring back to my village, and just to show that I'm a man. So, and they bought into it. It might be, I don't know, it might be true or it might be false, I don't know. But that's the perception. That's the perceptions Americans have on Africans. So I feel like, and everybody that I know or everybody that I've met, you know, like when you ask them, like Africans, like they're going to think that, oh, you poor, or like you used to live with lions and, I don't know, snakes, I don't know.
When you would tell these stories, would you watch people's eyes get really big, like this was...
Yeah, you could see the expression, and that makes them fear you. I kind of use that to my advantage too. Like, you gonna tell someone I killed a lion, they're gonna be afraid of you, and they're not gonna come at you. So that was a way for me to like make them be scared of me.
Has not worked with NBA big men. You figure that story's probably not gonna help you here. You've blown your cover now anyway, so.
No. I mean, the story might be true or might be false, and nobody would ever know. But if anybody tries me, they're going to find out.
Joel, your brother Arthur, you were just here. It was October of your rookie year when he was in a tragic accident. A car ran into a schoolyard. At that time, you had been in the States for 2 years of high school and a year of college, and then you're getting in your rookie year. You hadn't seen him in a long time. To go through that here,
How close did you come to just at times thinking, I'm just going to pack up and go home? That time in your life had to have been, I would imagine, the darkest, the most difficult thing you've ever had to deal with.
I wouldn't say that wasn't, that time wasn't really the darkest, because, you know, I'm really thankful for the team for allowing me to go back and just go to the funeral and spend time with my family. But the darkest time of my life was probably when I had to get the second surgery. And I think it was around a couple weeks later, was around when my brother died. And that's when I really thought about I just wanted to get away. I just wanted to quit. I just wanted to, like, just give up and just go back home and just live my life. But I love basketball so much that I don't think I would have had just the heart to, like, actually make that decision. But I just thought about some things I shouldn't have, and it was tough. You know, when you go through tough times and, you know, you have ideas going through your head, and, I mean, yeah.
At the time with the Sixers, Brett Brown, and at the time Sam Hinkie and teammates you had, your relationship, especially I think with Coach Brown, even though you were injured, and this doesn't necessarily happen everywhere in the NBA, you two stayed pretty connected almost every day or every day that the team was in town. What were your days like in terms of talking with Coach? I'm sure you talked about a lot more than just basketball and what was going on with the team. You were alone here, and you, like Coach said earlier, you just older than a teenager, living alone in a place. What role did Coach play in that for you, and how much did that sort of kind of get you from point A to point B and sort of keep you connected to everything that was going on here?
He made me feel great because, you know, talking to Coach almost every day, he wanted me to be around to know what was going on and about the team or about the NBA, about the system, or about the schemes and everything. So, it wasn't just about basketball. Always asking me about my family, how everybody's doing. And, you know, and we always, the main thing when we talked about basketball, we always talked about, what was coming for me when I got healthy. And, you know, he always wanted me to be a leader. So we always had all those meetings before games talking about I should be the leader. And, you know, it was, you know, Nernos was in there. When Ja came, Michael Carter Williams was in there too. So, and we had a bunch of meetings. You know, it was kind of, sometimes it was tiring, but it was good.
Brett, at the time, what was your role in Joel's life beyond just being his coach? At that point, what greater responsibility did you feel about the part you could play for him through two real difficult years?
I mean, it started with just that first year with the loss of his brother. You know, you go down to his apartment. We actually were playing the Celtics that night, and I left the game and had a chance to just go down and, you know, sort of be with Joel. And that for me was one of the darkest nights of my life. I mean, to see Joel in the state that he was in, and to feel very helpless on anything you could do to help other than just sort of be there to be with him was a long night. And I think that when you ultimately got him back on the court and back in our program, to be able to share stories with Joel on the experiences that I've been privileged to have. I mean, to see five NBA championships and be a part of four of them, and to be able to let Tim Duncan, you know, reach out to Joe and share stories, and to just help him navigate on-court, off-court stuff is stuff that I enjoy. I feel a responsibility to do it. And I think that when you really sort of dig into Joel, you understand that there is sort of a very self-aware person. I think that he's gifted intellectually on how he sort of sees the world and certainly the game. He catches me off guard all the time with the limited basketball experiences that he's had, how he sees the game at a very high level. and, you know, just enjoy his company, enjoy his sense of humor, and trying to put it on him to grow this program. We talk freely about the responsibility and opportunity that he has. And he lets me coach him. I need to coach him. He needs to be a leader. And that presents itself in different forms. And so, you know, it's just part of our initial journey.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Joel, Brett, sit tight for a moment so I can tell my listeners about SeatGeek. Buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process for a very long time. It's always been hard to find the best deal for that game or show that you want to go to, and none of the other ticket sites seem to want to change that, but SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that make it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. And it's pretty neat how they do it, too. They put all the tickets available on other sites into one place, so you save time and never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will tell you if the ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. That's a part of it that I love. Every arena, stadium is different. You can get a sense of exactly what your view is going to be, what the eye line to a game or show is going to be, and it really helps when buying a ticket for whatever you want to go to. I've got that SeatGeek app on my phone, and I use it all the time because it's simple and it works. And best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. They show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to trick you with big fees on the checkout page. Now listen closely to this next part because it's real important. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's $20 right into your pocket. And to get it, all you've got to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code, then enter promo code Woj, W-O-J. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It does not get any easier than that. So please support SeatGeek like they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code Woj today. And now back to my conversation with Joel Embiid and Brett Brown. Joel, Brett mentioned the conversations with Tim Duncan. How often would you talk over a period of time, and what did you guys discuss? What kind of conversations would you and Tim have?
The first time I talked to him was, I think, my first year when we played in San Antonio. Coach set up a meeting, and we talked for about 30 minutes. At first, I was really excited, and, you know, that's Tim Duncan. That's one of the coolest dudes, and he's a winner. So just talking to him, just talking about, you know, I think that day we mainly talked about basketball, and I basically wrote everything he says down, and I still look at whatever he said. And from that day, I didn't really, when talking to him, I was just in awe. Like, I was excited. Like, I didn't really get the opportunity to, like, really ask him a lot of questions because I was like, that's Tim Duncan. Like, that's the guy. That's the winner. That's the guy you have to, like, be better than, close to being what he used to be. And then from that time, you know, so we always texting. Always giving me advice. After my first game, he texted, he sent me this long message and just talking about how proud he was and, like, just telling me that it's gonna take time and just giving me advices.
Is there still a part of you that says, wow, Tim Duncan watched my game?
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's, it's kind of, I think he's been watching. He told me that he's been watching, so I figured he'd watch a couple of games here and there.
You're really a student of the game, and you watched a lot of tape. You watched a lot of videos, whether it's trying to emulate Hakeem Olajuwon as a young player, but lots of players and centers and I think other positions. When you watch guys and you want to take things in the gym and practice them, it's one thing to do that. It's another thing to now go out on the court and do it in the game, and you've been able to do that this season. What is that finally like to stop watching everyone else do it and emulate it to, I just did it in the game, I just did it to that guy? What does that do to you every night when you leave the gym and you go, hey, I did three or four things tonight that, you know, shook the arena.
This is exciting. You know, guys like Akeem, I've been watching him since the first day I started playing basketball. It's exciting, you know. And a lot of people freaked out about it the other day against Utah, or I don't know, the Dream Shake or whatever that was. So it just feels great to finally apply what you've been working on all these years, and I still got a long way to go, and I still got a lot of things I can perfect. Just practicing all those moves and like from a couple years ago and to now, and being able to like actually use them in the game, it just feels great.
You know, you're still on a minute restrictions. It was 20 and 24 minutes, and you work with the sports science people to, you know, make decisions about back-to-backs. Has it been easier than you thought it would be? Because once you get out there, I'm sure you feel great and you want to keep going, and you know if you played another 10 minutes, it might be the difference between winning and losing. How are you with the minute restrictions, just in terms of your emotions and the sense of, come on, I feel good, let me go, versus there's a plan in place?
It's really tough to deal with. You know, some nights you just feel great and you just want to keep playing. Or I always give Coach Brown a hard time of, like, you know, just starting the game, we up by 10 points, I don't know, 10 to 2, and I only played 4 minutes, so I just want to keep it going. But, you know, there's a plan in place. Because if I keep playing, I might not be able to like finish the game and help the team win. So it's frustrating, but like I've been saying, these guys, they care about me, and the plan they have in place for me, I just got to follow it. And like I was saying earlier, like patience, I learned to be patient during my second time rehabbing, and I'm going to keep being patient.
You mentioned social media before, and you'd hear people say all kinds of different things. And if you look at it closely enough, you'll see a lot of praise. You'll see a lot of abuse. Whatever you're looking for, you'll find it. Were there times when your whole world was pretty limited, if you were in your apartment a lot, where you felt like very caught up in there and you were listening and looking at what everyone said? Do you wean yourself off of that after a while, now that you're playing and you're out there? Because it can paralyze you sometimes, criticism or what people are saying, if you just sort of absorb it all. How have you learned to handle it, or do you handle it differently now than you did when you walked in here as a rookie?
Coming into the league, you know, a lot of people told me that it was going to happen, and it kind of started in college too. And I used coming into the league, and I never like read my mentions and whatever people were saying. I stopped doing that. And now I kind of do. And it just, like, one thing I learned is that, like, everybody's going to have their own opinion, and you can do nothing about it. They're going to praise you and they're going to hate you. It doesn't matter. Like, one thing I learned is it's just every time I see something bad, it's just laughable. I just laugh and be like, man, I don't. So it doesn't bother me anymore.
Your sense of humor, you created your own identity on Twitter, because you could make people laugh. You could laugh at yourself sometimes. If something was written about you, you could sort of take it head on by joking about it, and that diffuses everything. And some people live to be 65, 70 and never learn to do that, and you did it as a 21, 22-year-old. But the idea of being on the floor now, and that's what people are starting to judge you on, and they're seeing it's not anymore what might he be. They're seeing it happen. How does it impact the way you feel about yourself and the way even you carry yourself?
You know, when I play, I basically play for my family and for the Sixers. So just knowing that I have people that can back me up, and if I have a good game or if I have a bad game, I can come in and talk to coaches about what I did wrong and what I did, what was good. So that's basically what I care about. I care about who I play for, and that's for my family and the Sixers organization. And as long as I keep doing that, that's what satisfies me.
I know you're anticipating the chance to get to play with Ben Simmons, and once he's healthy, what role have you been able to play for him? He's going through a lot of the same, exactly the same of what you did. Have you taken it on yourself, Joel, to kind of be there for him the way maybe some others had been here for you during your times away?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, the main thing I've been telling him is patience. That patience is going to pay off. And, you know, like I said, my first time, I kind of rushed everything because I wanted to get back on the court. And, you know, and he has the team to back him up on that. Nobody's going to rush him. And, like, I know he loves basketball. So you just got to be patient. So the main thing I've been able to tell him, my message for him is just patience. Just be patient and everything's going to happen.
You've watched in the past when the team, we talked about it earlier, has been on long losing streaks. The Sixers are still trying to win their first game, and you'll have that couple games here this weekend. How anxious are you just to be a part of helping to get a win? And I think, as you guys know here, once you get a win, some of that burden kind of comes off, and then you can just play. How anxious are you to, I'm sure last night watching in Indiana was not easy when you see a game down the stretch and you imagine, hey, I could make a difference, but how much does that weigh on your mind?
You know, we haven't been able to get a win. Like I said earlier, we could easily be 4-2. We haven't been able to close our games, and we've been making mistakes, but I think after we get and we're gone, I look forward to playing tomorrow against Indiana again at home. That's going to be a good matchup for us to finally get a win. And just saying yesterday, watching the game play, I kind of get a sense of I'm going to help the team win. And like you said, once you get that first win, everybody just falls in place. And I think we're starting to trust each other. We're still learning how to play with each other. We're starting to trust each other. And yesterday, I thought, to close out the game, I thought we did a better job than we have done in the past. And I just can't wait for tomorrow.
Brett, what you've gotten from Joel so far, you've watched him play more than anybody else has in the gym and practice. Has he even exceeded your expectations for a player who'd really been off 2 years? Did you expect him to be this good, this dominant at times, as quickly as he has, less than, you know, 10 games into a career that was stalled for two full years?
I think the thing that comes first to my mind, when, because I'm asked this question a lot, is the way that he has scored has caught me off guard. Because you have somebody at 7'2" trail in and hit a three. You've got somebody at a low post that's got a, you know, traditional pound-pound jump hook or turn and face, you know, jab step, 18-foot jump shot. And the variety, the package that he scores has caught me off guard. I think the evolution of him and him getting his legs underneath himself and playing, you know, NBA basketball, where right now his mind is faster than his feet. You know, he thinks it, I see clearly, and then just moving, you know, on NBA court and playing the game again. Once the collision of those two things happen, then I think, you know, you add that into unrestricted minutes and you've got something very, very elite. Those things come to my mind.
Joel, what Coach said there about sometimes your mind's ahead of, and that's where the great ones, when they can see things and anticipate things that are there. Sometimes it takes a while for NBA players, especially when they're making a transition, the game's fast and it's faster than they're used to, and it takes a long time. Is it slower than you imagine? Do you see things on the court happening ahead of it? Do you feel like that process has been real quick for you?
I feel like I'm still adjusting to the pace of the game, you know, speed and everything, but I feel like I've been able to, like, keep track. And the thing I still got to work on is my conditioning. I still get tired really fast out there. But, you know, Coach has been talking about me being a defensive centerpiece, and that's what I think defensively, that's what I've been really focused on and trying to do my best and, like, try to help the team be a better defensive team. And like you said, I feel like I still don't have my legs to, like, from like 2 years ago, I'm not as athletic as I was yet. So those are some of the things I got to work on. And, you know, I actually been surprised with the way I've been playing. I thought I was going to come out and just not be as good as I've been doing. But it's been a surprise to me too. And it's a learning process. And just day by, you just got to take day by day, get better every day and trying to help the team win.
Joel, I appreciate you taking the time out. Coach Brown, a lot of fun visiting with you guys, and maybe tomorrow night against Indiana, Orlando. I know that first one's coming, and you know it's downhill after that. So thanks, guys. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. Big thank you to my guest today, Sixers center Joel Embiid and Coach Brett Brown. Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to the podcast. And be sure to subscribe to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix and the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick. You can find us on thevertical.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Spotify, and you can hear the Vertical Podcast Network every weekday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. I'd also like to take a moment to give a big thanks to today's sponsors, SeatGeek and Movement Watches. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. We'll catch you next time.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.